Welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Are you a Jeopardy fan? Devoted to Alex Trebek? Perhaps you preferred Art Fleming as the host. And let's not forget SNL's Will Ferrell as the long-suffering Alex. Today, with an entertaining nod to Jeopardy's popular potpourri category, we'll preview the summer's hottest books in a wide range of categories. Fiction, nonfiction, travel, and occult, there's a title for every taste. My guest today, Patrick Nolan, oversees the editorial direction of Penguin Books' publishing program. We'll speak with him about Penguin's 80 years as a leader in the publishing world. So why not settle in with a potent potable and get ready to enjoy today's literary lineup? Let's turn now to page one of the book report. Barbarian Days is William Finnegan's memoir of an obsession. To many, surfing looks like a sport. But to those who know it intimately, it's a beautiful addiction, a demanding course of study, a dangerous pastime, a way of life. Raised in California and Hawaii, Finnegan, who performs the book, started surfing as a child. He's chased waves all over the world, wandering through the South Pacific, Australia, Asia, and Africa. A bookish boy, then an excessively adventurous young man, Finnegan went on to become a distinguished writer and war reporter. As Finnegan's travels take him far afield, he becomes an improbable anthropologist, unpicking the simplicity of a Samoan fishing village, dissecting the sexual politics of Tongan interactions with Americans and Japanese, navigating the Indonesian black market. Barbarian Days takes us deep into unfamiliar worlds. He details the intricacy of famous waves and his own apprenticeships to them.
I had never thought of myself as a sheltered child. Still, Kaimuki Intermediate School was a shock. We'd just moved to Honolulu. I was in the eighth grade, and most of my new schoolmates were drug addicts, glue sniffers, and hoods. Or so I wrote to a friend back in Los Angeles. That wasn't true. What was true was that Howleys, white people, I was one of them, were a tiny and unpopular minority at Kaimuki. The natives, as I called them, seemed to dislike us particularly. This was unnerving because many of the Hawaiians were, for junior high kids, alarmingly large, and the word was that they liked to fight. Orientals, again my terminology, were the school's biggest ethnic group. In those first weeks, I didn't distinguish between Japanese and Chinese and Korean kids. They were all Orientals to me. Nor did I note the existence of other important tribes, such as the Filipinos, the Samoans, or the Portuguese, not considered Haole, let alone all the kids of mixed ethnic background. I probably even thought the big guy in woodshop, who immediately took a sadistic interest in me, was Hawaiian. He wore shiny black shoes with long, sharp toes, tight pants, and bright flowered shirts. His kinky hair was cut in a pompadour, and he looked like he'd been shaving since birth. He rarely spoke, and then only in a pidgin unintelligible to me. He was some kind of junior mobster, clearly years behind his original class, just biding his time until he could drop out. His name was Freitas. I never heard a first name. But he didn't seem to be related to the Freitas clan, a vast family with a number of rambunctious boys at Kaimuki Intermediate. The stiletto-toed Freitas studied me frankly for a few days, making me increasingly nervous, and then began to conduct little assaults on my self-possession, softly bumping my elbow, for example, while I concentrated over a saw cut on my half-built shoeshine box. I was too scared to say anything, and he never said a word to me. That seemed to be part of the fun. Then he settled on a crude but ingenious amusement to pass those periods when we had to sit in chairs in the classroom part of the shop. He would sit behind me, and whenever the teacher had his back turned, would hit me on the head with a 2x4. Bonk, bonk, bonk. A nice steady rhythm, always with enough of a pause between blows to allow me brief hope that there might not be another. I couldn't understand why the teacher didn't hear all these unauthorized, resonating clonks. They were loud enough to attract the attention of our classmates, who seemed to find Freitas' little ritual fascinating. Inside my head, the blows were, of course, bone-rattling explosions. Freitas used a fairly long board, 5 or 6 feet, and he never hit too hard, which allowed him to pound away to his heart's content without leaving marks, and to do it from a certain rarefied, even meditative distance, which added, I imagine, to the fascination of the performance. I wonder if, had some other kid been targeted, I would have been as passive as my classmates were. Probably so. The teacher was off in his own world, worried only about his table saws. I did nothing in my own defense. While I eventually understood that Freitas wasn't Hawaiian, I must have figured I just had to take the abuse. I was, after all, skinny and howly and had no friends. My parents had sent me to Kaimuki Intermediate, I later decided, under a misconception. This was 1966, and the California public school system, particularly in the middle-class suburbs where we had lived, was among the nation's best. The families we knew never considered private schools for their kids. Hawaii's public schools were another matter. Impoverished, mired in colonial, plantation, and mission traditions, miles below the American average academically. You would not have known that, though, from the elementary school my younger siblings attended. Kevin was 9, Colleen 7, Michael was 3, and in that preschool era, still exempt from formal education. We'd rented a house on the edge of a wealthy neighborhood called Kahala, and Kahala Elementary was a well-funded little haven of progressive education. Except for the fact that the children were allowed to go to school barefoot.
We've just heard Barbarian Days by William Finnegan. Patrick Nolan joined Penguin Books as associate publisher and editor-in-chief in 2012, after serving for 12 years as trade paperback sales director for the Penguin Group. He now oversees Penguin Books' publishing program. In his previous roles at Penguin, he contributed to such long-running bestsellers as Eat, Pray, Love, The Omnivore's Dilemma, The Secret Life of Bees, The Kite Runner, and The Help. Before coming to Penguin, Patrick was sales director for Disney Hyperion and worked at Houghton Mifflin and Waterstones Booksellers. Welcome, Patrick. Thanks for joining us today. Welcome, Patrick, and thanks for joining us today on The Book Report.
My pleasure. It's great to be here.
Penguin has held such an important place in the world of publishing. How did the company get started?
It has a kind of an amazing history. Alan Lane, 80 years ago, was out having lunch with Agatha Christie outside of London, and on his way back into London, wandering around the train station looking for a book to read, he couldn't find anything good. He found magazines and he found some kind of trashy Victorian pulp fiction, but nothing that he wanted to read. And he felt that was a big problem and a big opportunity. And he went back to London. He was working at sort of a traditional publisher, the Bodley Head at the time, but he gathered a couple of executives from there and started a business in the basement of a church, publishing 10 books at first. And his idea was to publish inexpensive paperbacks of quality that all readers could read and find in any place, not just in those high street bookstores.
To the best of my knowledge, there are no penguins in England. So why did they choose a penguin as their image?
There's so many myths and stories, and we all imagine exotic animals being brought in to audition this coveted logo and name of the company. But in actuality, his assistant suggested the idea, and he thought it was a good one, and they immediately got to work designing the logo. So it was kind of a simple thing. No test groups, no marketing studies. It was just a really great idea from a member of his staff.
I lived overseas for a lot of years, and whenever I walked into a bookstore that had some English language books, I always looked for the Penguin Classics. When did Penguin Classics begin, and how many in the collection now?
Penguin Classics started shortly after the 1935 founding of the company, about 5 years later. And with the translations by E.V. Rue, which are still in print, of the Iliad and Odyssey as some of the very first books. It's grown now to a 1,300-book list that's developed by an editorial team that works together both in London and here in New York under our direction of Elder Roeder. And it's an amazing list. I love it and so proud of it because in the last few years in particular, it's become a truly global list, and it's not just the Western and American literature that sort of was the canon of the 20th century. It's now expanded to include, we're going to publish our first Korean book next year. We've published books from the Philippines, Latin America, the Caribbean. So we really now have a truly global list.
So the company sometimes publishes a book, for example, in Portuguese and not in English?
Oh, no, sorry. Those are all translations.
Okay.
Commissioned translations. Yeah, we publish, with rare exception, I think there's maybe four books on our list that are in foreign language that I can think of that are designed for teaching Italian, French, those kinds of like short stories. But otherwise, all our books are in English. So we commission translations of great works outside of the English language.
Mm. What are some of the largest selling titles in Penguin's history?
Ooh, well, John Steinbeck gets right to the top very fast. And he's probably our biggest seller of all time. And One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is right up there behind him. In recent history, we've had Mega Million best-selling success with Sue Monk Kidd's Secret Life of Bees, Kim Edwards' The Memory Keeper's Daughter. We currently have the number one book on the New York Times nonfiction list, The Boys in the Boat, which has only been out for us for just a year now, and it's already a million copies, and it's number one week after week, so I hope it'll become one of our biggest bestsellers of all time. A lot of books, both old and new, that are big bestsellers.
What percentage of Penguin books are sold in the digital edition versus print?
We are selling, I'd say, you know, ballpark about 25 to 30% of our books digitally, which is pretty much what the industry is seeing. And that's gone from being like 1 or 2% as little as 5 years ago to a big piece of our business now. So it was a massive, fast change that now seems to be stabilizing. I think people have, you know, there are people who only want to read digital and people who only want to read physical, and a lot of people like me who do both. And it seems like the market has kind of settled a little bit after a lot of change very quickly.
We're speaking with Patrick Nolan on The Book Report. So many of us readers wonder, how does a company choose its book list each year? Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's one of the key things that I do in my job. Working with my editorial team, we're constantly looking for the next big thing and things that fit into our list and our mission of publishing great books for as many readers as we can. So we're looking at submissions all the time. I spend most of my reading life reading books that may or may not end up on the Penguin list because the first thing is reading them. So we get submissions every day. Probably while I've been talking to you, I've probably received a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And we us editors, because I'm an editor also, we champion the books we're most interested in, and we look for consensus amongst our colleagues. And ultimately, there's a chain of command you need to speak to get the green light to go ahead and make an offer, and then the fun begins.
So an unknown and unpublished author can submit a manuscript and hope.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that's the most efficient way. I always recommend to new writers that I meet that they do everything they can to match themselves with the right agent, because the agents really know the industry, they know the editors, they know the imprints, and they can be that really great matchmaker of finding the right fit for a writer and an editor. So I think that's a much better way to do it. And over the long run, it'll be more satisfying and successful, I think.
Well, tell us how the company is celebrating its 80th year.
We're doing a lot of things, and it's all around what we do kind of every day, which is working hard to serve our authors. We have centennials for Arthur Miller and Saul Bellow. We are publishing two really fun gift-type books for the fall. One is called The Journey of the Penguin, which is that sort of imaginative story of finding the penguin for the logo that I mentioned earlier, where Alan Lane has all these different animals in on a stage, choosing in the end the penguin. We have this wonderful box set called Little Black Classics, where we'll have 80 small paperback classics all in one box, beautifully packaged, celebrating kind of the breadth of the penguin classics list. We have our penguin truck traveling around the country. We're doing a contest with schools and school children where they can win 80 books for their library from Penguin. We have a scavenger hunt happening on our own Penguin social media for our readers to also win a 80 book library. And in the end, you know, in a way, there's no big party like our 75th anniversary. It is really about the books this year. You know, we're 80 years old. We got to take this seriously.
Well, tell us about, I know there's a very fun trivia quiz. Where can I find that?
Oh, yeah, you can find that on our website, penguinbooks.com, and it's the 80th anniversary link. And it is a really fun test. I was hoping you wouldn't ask me any of the questions because I don't know if I can answer all of them myself. Some of them are hard.
No, I know. I looked at it, and I'm a pretty big reader, and I certainly didn't know a lot of them. Okay, here's a tough question. How is the company going to change in the next 80 years?
Good question. You know, it's interesting. The core idea of Alan Lane lives in everything we do. In terms of finding readers, publishing great books, making them affordable, the widest possible market. So that core idea, I can't imagine changing in 80 years. But 80 years ago, Alan Lane probably wasn't thinking there'd be divisions all around the world that would be selling 600 million books a year here in the U.S. for Penguin Books. So I'm not going to try and predict, because I saw a lot of people guess that we're all going to be reading only on digital platforms in 3 or 4 years, just a couple of years ago, and that clearly isn't happening. So I think a lot of it will be very similar. It'll just be, you know, more great books, but I can't predict exactly what great books they'll be, but I hope a lot of them are Penguin.
Okay, Patrick, it's great to speak with you today, and thanks for filling us in on the 80th year celebration.
Thank you. That's so nice to hear. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Bye now.
Bye.
With the current popularity of the movie Paper Towns, I'm thinking you want more John Green. Let's listen to Dan John Miller's performance of the book. Quentin Jacobson has spent a lifetime loving the magnificently adventurous Margot Roth Spiegelman from afar. So when she cracks open a window and climbs back into his life, dressed like a ninja and summoning him for an ingenious campaign of revenge, he follows. After their all-nighter ends and a new day breaks, Q arrives at school to discover that Margot, always an enigma, has now become a mystery. But Q soon learns that there are clues, and they're for him. Urged down a disconnected path, the closer he gets, the less Q sees of the girl he thought he knew.
I'd been in this park so many times before that it was mapped in my mind, so we were only a few steps inside when I began to sense that the world was out of order, even though I couldn't immediately figure out what was different. Quentin, Margot said, quietly, calmly. She was pointing, and then I realized what was different. There was a live oak a few feet ahead of us, thick and gnarled and ancient-looking. That was not new. The playground on our right, not new either. But now a guy wearing a gray suit slumped against the trunk of the oak tree, not moving. This was new. He was encircled by blood, a half-dried fountain of it poured out of his mouth, the mouth open in a way that mouths generally shouldn't be, flies at rest on his pale forehead. "He's dead," Margot said, as if I couldn't tell. I took two small steps backward. I remember thinking that if I made any sudden movements, he might wake up and attack me. Maybe he was a zombie. I knew zombies weren't real, but he sure looked like a potential zombie. As I took those two steps back, Margot took two equally small and quiet steps forward. "His eyes are open," she said.
We gotta go home, I said.
I thought you closed your eyes when you died, she said.
Margot, we gotta go home and tell.
She took another step. She was close enough now to reach out and touch his foot.
What do you think happened to him?
She asked.
Maybe it was drugs or something.
I didn't want to leave Margot alone with the dead guy who might be an attack zombie, but I also didn't care to stand around and chat about the circumstances of his demise. I gathered my courage and stepped forward to take her hand.
Margot, we gotta go right now.
Okay, yeah, she said. We ran to our bikes, my stomach churning with something that felt exactly like excitement, but wasn't. We got on our bikes and I let her go in front of me because I was crying and didn't want her to see. I could see blood on the soles of her purple sneakers. His blood. The dead guy blood. And then we were back home in our separate houses. My parents called 911, and I heard the sirens in the distance and asked to see the fire trucks, but my mom said no. Then I took a nap. Both my parents are therapists, which means that I am really goddamned well-adjusted. So when I woke up, I had a long conversation with my mom about the cycle of life and how death is part of life, but not a part of life I needed to be particularly concerned about at the age of 9, and I felt better. Honestly, I never worried about it much, which is saying something, because I can do some worrying. Here's the thing. I found a dead guy. Little, adorable, 9-year-old me and my even littler and more adorable playdate found a guy with blood pouring out of his mouth, and that blood was on her little, adorable sneakers as we biked home. It's all very dramatic and everything, but so what? I didn't know the guy. People I don't know die all the damn time. If I had a nervous breakdown every time something awful happened in the world, I'd be crazier than a house rat. That night, I went into my room at 9 o'clock to go to bed, because 9 o'clock was my bedtime. My mom tucked me in, told me she loved me, and I said, "See you tomorrow." And she said, "See you tomorrow." And then she turned out the lights and closed the door almost all the way. As I turned on my side, I saw Margot Roth Spiegelman standing outside my window, her face almost pressed against the screen. I got up and opened the window, but the screen stayed between us, pixelating her.
"I did an investigation,"
she said quite seriously. Even up close, the screen broke her face apart, but I could tell that she was holding a little notebook and a pencil with teeth marks around the eraser. She glanced down at her notes.
"Mrs. Feldman from over on Jefferson Court said his name was Robert Joyner. She told me he lived on Jefferson Road in one of those condos on top of the grocery store. So I went over there, and there were a bunch of policemen, and one of them asked if I worked at the school paper, and I said our school didn't have a paper, and he said as long as I wasn't a journalist, he would answer my questions."
That was Paper Towns by John Green. In Martin Clark's The Jezebel Remedy, husband and wife team Lisa and Joe Stone are sole partners in their small law firm in Henry County, Virginia. They handle less than glamorous cases, domestic disputes, personal injury settlements, and a plethora of complaints from their cantankerous client, Letty Van Sant. When eccentric Letty dies in a freakish accident, the Stones think it's within the realm of possibility she was cooking meth in her trailer. But details emerge that lead them to question how accidental Letty's demise actually was. Settling her peculiar estate becomes endlessly complicated. Before long, the Stones find themselves embroiled in a corporate conspiracy that will require all of their legal prowess, not to mention some serious guts. Morgan Hallett performs the book.
Her mama was killed by a monstrous clot and never woke up from a new nap. The laundry still wooden pinned to an outside line. A pound of shrimp thawing in the sink. A candy dish filled with pink, yellow, and green buttermints on the dining room table, ready for Wednesday Bridge Club. Her darling dad was gone a month later, walloped by a massive stroke. So tough, he'd held on for almost a week before he died, barely 70, paralyzed and grimacing in a hospital bed and unable to speak. And it was impossible to sit through two sweltering Baptist funerals and not wonder when her day was coming, whether she was wasting her own precious time. Also, and she tried not to be hateful about it, but bless his heart, some of Joe's quirks and habits had become a pain for her, and this wasn't helping her disposition either. The charming cowboy boots she'd cottoned to back in law school now struck her as Henry County hayseed if he wore them off the farm. Naming their shaggy black puppy with a single white spot on his flank Brownie was genius. But then came Katrina and New Orleans, and Joe hit his own endless jackpot, and every time, every freaking time, the mutt would roll over or shake hands or fetch his tennis ball, as predictable as a cuckoo clock at half-hour intervals. Joe would crucify her last nerve with the "heck of a job, Brownie" line, and yesterday, in 2010, he repeated it again, praising the dog for scratching at the kitchen door. The same slobbering ruckus every Wednesday, the pooch eager for the front yard, where he could bark and greet the garbage truck. Joe would absolutely ignite and go full Lewis, her term, after Jerry Lewis's spastic Nutty Professor, whenever he heard the opening riff of Black Coffee in Bed or Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes' Bad Luck. No matter how many times he'd listened to the intro, no matter how dated and old hat the songs. At work, there was the trite shave and a haircut knock, despite her begging him not to do it ever again, please. He would make her sit in his office, and he'd call the shareholders' meeting to order, and they'd vote on replacing the gutters or buying a new computer, even though it was only them, Joe and Lisa, husband and wife. They were the entire law firm. She was weary of his corny, great googly moogly, and at the other end of the spectrum, his crass, indiscriminate use of the word. Worst was his riding a motor scooter, not a motorcycle, mind you, to town in warm weather, his huge man putt-putting down Starling Avenue. An embarrassing big-ass helmet strapped underneath his chin so that he favored the great Gazoo, the crazy cartoon alien from the Flintstones. And yeah, of course he knew the whole deal was goofy. But she was unable to convince him that even a maximum dose of self-awareness and a tongue-in-cheek penumbra can't save some choices from coming off as idiotic. To be fair about it, she realized that some of her failings had to bother him, especially how she often forgot to completely close the dresser drawers and occasionally spilled nail polish on the bathroom tile and never returned the living room phone to its base. And there were probably heaps of other irritations that he was too decent to mention. He kept things in check much better than she did. She loved him, though. She did. Loved him in the fashion, she supposed, that you love a spouse hamstrung by 2 decades of marriage. Loved him with most of the shiny paint scrubbed off, the gloss long ago weathered away, her affection down to the solid girders and nuts and bolts and sturdy welds, the steel guts of the arrangement.
That was a sampling of The Jezebel Remedy by Martin Clark. Janet Ivanovich teams up with Fief Sutton in Wicked Charms, book 3 of the Lizzie and Diesel series. Murdered and mummified nearly a century ago, bootlegger Collier Pegleg Dazzle discovered and re-hid a famous pirate's treasure somewhere along the coast of New England. A vast collection of gold and silver coins and precious gems, the bounty also contains the Stone of Avarice, the item reluctant treasure seeker Lizzie Tucker and her partner Diesel seek. While Lizzie would just like to live a quiet, semi-normal life, Diesel is all about the hunt. Greed is eternal and insatiable, and Lizzie and Diesel aren't the only ones searching for the lost pirate's chest. People who've dedicated their lives to finding it are willing to commit murder. Lorelei King performs the swashbuckler.
My name is Lizzie Tucker.
and I live in a small, slightly tilted historic house that sits on a hill overlooking Marblehead Harbor in Massachusetts. I inherited the house from my great-aunt Ophelia when I was 28, and I'm not much older now. I share the house with a tiger-striped, short-haired cat. When he was rescued from the shelter, his tag said Cat 7143, and it stuck as his name. Cat has one eye, half a tail, and I'm pretty sure he was a ninja in a past life. I'm a Johnson & Wales culinary school graduate, and when I'm not being asked to save the world, I work as a pastry chef at Dazzle's Bakery in Salem. It was 10 o'clock at night. Cat and I were watching television in bed, and a big, scruffy, incredibly hot guy walked into my bedroom. "What the heck?" I asked. "Where did you come from?" "Originally, Switzerland, but I was mostly raised in Southern California." "That's not what I mean. What are you doing in my bedroom?" He kicked his shoes off. "I'm undressing, and then I'm going to bed." "No, not allowed. Extenuating circumstance," he said, peeling off his shirt. "I'm between places of residence." "I don't care if you're between a rock and a hard spot. You can't stay here." His jeans hit the floor. "Of course I can. We're partners." "We're not that kind of partners. We work together. We're not supposed to be, you know." "Don't get your panties in a bunch. I have total self-control." I leaned forward for a closer look. "Are those parrots on your boxers?" "I got them in Key West. Cool, right?" "Okay. I have to admit it. The whole package was cool. The guy's name is Diesel. That's it. Only one name. And the name suits him, because he plows over you like a freight train. He's over 6 feet of hard-muscled male perfection. His dark blonde hair is thick and sun-streaked and perpetually mussed. His eyes are brown and unreadable. His smile is like Christmas morning. His attitude is deceptive, casual on the outside but intense on the inside. His moral code is all his own." "All right, you win," I said, knowing there was no way I could physically remove him. "You can sleep on the couch." He stuck his thumb into the waistband on his boxers. "I don't fit on the couch." "Hey," I said, "wait a minute." Too late. The boxers were on the floor with his shirt and jeans. I clapped my hands over my eyes. "I can't believe you just did that." "I sleep nude. Women don't usually mind." "I mind." "I get that," Diesel said. "Move over." I have a queen-size bed, plenty big enough for me and Cat, not big enough for me and Cat and Diesel. Truth is, I wouldn't mind getting romantic with Diesel, but we have an odd relationship. Diesel isn't normal, and it would seem that I'm not normal either. I thought I was normal until Diesel popped into my life shortly after I moved to Marblehead. Now weird is the new normal. The way Diesel tells it, there are some people on Earth who have enhanced abilities that can't be explained in ordinary ways. They might be useful abilities, such as Diesel's talent for opening locks. Or they might be hellacious powers, such as calling down lightning or levitating a garbage truck. Crazy, right? It gets even better. Supposedly, there are 7 ancient stones that hold the powers of the 7 deadly sins. They're known as the 7 Seligia stones. If these stones fall into the wrong hands, all hell will, quite literally, break loose. I'm one of 2 people in the world who have the ability to locate the stones, sort of like a human divining rod. Lucky me. So far, Diesel and I have acquired 2 of the stones, nearly getting blown up and kidnapped and chopped into tiny pieces with a broadsword in the process. When we find a stone, Diesel sends it off to some higher power for safekeeping. At least that's his story. "We're not supposed to sleep together," I said. "Sleeping is okay. Getting busy, not so much."
That was Wicked Charms by Janet Ivanovich and Fief Sutton. Austin Grossman's Crooked reimagines the Cold War as an epic battle against the occult, waged by the ultimate American anti-hero, Richard Nixon. Nixon lived one of the most improbable lives of the 20th century.
Our 37th president's political career spanned the button-down 50s through the turbulent 70s. He faced down the Russians, the Chinese, and ultimately his own government. The man went from political mastermind to national joke, sobbing in the Oval Office, leaving us with one burning question. How could he have lost it all? Here, for the first time, is the supernatural secret he stumbled upon as a young man, the truth behind the Cold War, and the truth behind the Watergate cover-up. What if our nation's worst president was actually a pivotal figure caught in a desperate struggle between ordinary life and horrors from another reality? What if the man we call our worst president was, in truth, one of the greatest? Combining Lovecraftian suspense and international intrigue, Grossman's novel is a masterwork of alternative history, equal parts character study and Faustian thriller. Kif van der Heuvel performs the book.
Agent Hunt broke it down for them. "We recovered a few pages from a DNC research project," he told them. "We knew they were pulling behind, and it seems like they're a little more desperate than we thought. They've started drawing from a different playbook." He held up a Xeroxed page of densely written Cyrillic, the word Gregor circled in two places. "Maybe some of you recognize that name. If you do, you know it's not politics as usual anymore. Nobody likes going outside the law, but I assure you, the president is fully behind us on this one. We cleaned the place out. This time tomorrow, you'll be on your way, and no one will ever hear about what happened." He glanced at me. There were people in the room who already knew this was not true. The first team went out, Henry and the rest of them, and the second team, the ones whose names you will know from the newspapers, were left. After a while, McCord went upstairs to tape the locks on the fire doors, and I came back here to wait. It had been my office for 4 years. I cleared everything out when I arrived because of Kennedy. Kennedy's desk was nice, but I wanted a broader writing surface, and I like a darker wood, and I don't like to sit where he sat. God knows what went on here. The new desk was supposed to have been Woodrow Wilson's, a man I admire. The 28th president was a sorcerer of no small ability within his limits. Better than Eisenhower, if you ask me. Until in 1918 he went too far, made a pact that brought the Great Plague. His dyslexia held him back, not to mention his education. There are some things they don't teach you at Princeton. The Wilson desk was a PR coup until, and it took Sapphire to point it out, we found out it wasn't Woodrow Wilson's at all. It was Henry Wilson's, a vice president who served under the Great Butcher, who, incidentally, had the least human blood of anyone to serve in the office. The desk, I found, had several secret compartments. One contained papers handwritten in an unknown alphabet and bearing the signature of James Madison. Another held a bronze dagger inscribed with the opening words of the Declaration of Independence. A third one was empty, and objects placed inside it for longer than 8 hours would reliably vanish. I never found out to where. Nothing is ever the way you think it's going to be, not even the job of your dreams. I lit a cigarette. Pat would be asleep by now. No one awake but me and the security guards. Franklin D. Roosevelt built the modern version of the Oval Office in the 30s. He had some strange help, and it still has some strange properties. At this hour, it can feel like a time machine going back, back to the barren swampland that once was here, the square miles of muck and still black water. In November 1620, 500 miles to the north, 102 British settlers arrived and started dying. Half of them went almost immediately, from diseases caught during the journey coupled with no food and a killing winter. Only 4 adult women survived that first year. Fugitive Protestant mystics, Tillys and Martins and Chiltons, they huddled together in half-built log halls, reading by firelight on the edge of a frozen continent next to a dark forest that stretched westward all the way to the Mississippi. They couldn't even bury their dead. Outside, the snow had fallen 6 feet deep, and there were moving shapes in the night. They were 53 people without a country, watching one another die until one of them, we will never know who, walked out into the darkness to do what none of the others would. The colony at Roanoke had died. Plymouth would live. I stubbed out the cigarette and took off my jacket. The phone rang, once. It meant that Henry's shadow team was climbing the hotel stairway to the 8th floor.
We've just heard Crooked by Austin Grossman. In the tradition of Bill Bryson, Rinker Buck's The Oregon Trail is an epic account of traveling the entire 2,000-mile length of the Oregon Trail the old-fashioned way, in a covered wagon with a team of mules. Spanning 2,000 miles and traversing 6 states from Missouri to the Pacific Ocean, the Oregon Trail is the route that made America. In the 15 years before the Civil War, 400,000 pioneers used it to emigrate west. Historians still regard this as the largest land migration of all time. The trail united the coast, doubled the size of the country, and laid the groundwork for the railroads. Buck, who narrates, shares his recent journey with humor and heart.
I had known long before I rode a covered wagon to Oregon that naivete was the mother of adventure. I just didn't understand how much of that I really had. Nicholas and I realized before we left Missouri with the mules that we would be the first wagon travelers in more than a century to make an authentic crossing of the Oregon Trail. But that was never the point for us. We pushed mules almost 2,000 miles to learn something more important, even more beautiful than the land that we passed or the months spent camping on the plains, was learning to live with uncertainty. The trip was my idea, and I fell into it in my usual barmy way. A few summers ago, while taking an afternoon off from a story I was working on in the Flint Hills of Kansas, I stopped on the road near a stout granite monument that marked a set of wheel ruts disappearing northwest across the plains. Junction of Oregon Trail with Overland Trail, 60 rods southeast. Enchanted by the idea that I could step from a modern paved road onto the tracks of the 19th century pioneers, not to mention walk all the way to Oregon, I paused just long enough to grab a water bottle and a brimmed hat from my car and set out along the ruts, heading west. It was a beautiful, breezy day with sprays of yellow coreopsis blooming above the grasses and meadowlarks bobbing over the hills. The old ruts sloped over several gentle rises, past clumps of cottonwood trees and low shrubs at the watercourses, and handsome timber bridges that crossed two streams. The expansiveness of the landscape was hypnotic and physically exhilarating, and after the first mile I felt as if I were levitating on the plains. The distant hills of Nebraska seemed to draw my vision hundreds of miles away. A few miles up, I stopped to admire the view after climbing a steep rise. The valley below was one of those dreamy western vistas out of an Albert Bierstadt painting, a U-shaped canyon framed on one side by a large stream and on the other by green and brown hills. In the middle, a tidy group of shingled rooftops glowed orange in the sun, surrounded by browsing cattle. I walked down to the stream, where a sign announced that I had reached the old Hollenberg Ranch and Pony Express Station along the Oregon Trail. The restored ranch and Pony Express Station are maintained by the Kansas State Historical Society, and at the Interpretive Center there, built near a modern parking lot, I learned about the place. Garrett Hollenberg was a German immigrant who had first crossed the Oregon Trail during the 1849 California Gold Rush. He made a small fortune in the Northern California gold fields, then lost it in a shipwreck off Florida, and was drawn back to Kansas in 1854 by his memories of the beautiful prairie and dreams of founding a business along the busy, covered wagon trail he had seen 5 years before. At the time, marginalized American farmers westering for cheap land in the Northwest, religious zealots, and just dreamers in search of adventure were flooding across the Kansas frontier, and in peak years as many as 50,000 covered wagon immigrants spent the summer crossing the Oregon Trail and its two main tributaries, the California and Mormon Trails. Entrepreneurs intent on profiting from this traffic were building a network of road ranches along the remote stretches of the trail, providing a kind of early log cabin convenience store for the passing wagons. Hollenberg selected a site along Cottonwood Creek to attract pioneers who needed to water their draft animals and replenish their drinking barrels at the end of their first week crossing the prairie, and apparently he chose well. The trading post and wagon repair shop he built on the plains, later his wife added an outdoor kitchen and sold hot meals, were quickly heralded in published trail guides as the last major layover until Fort Kearney in Nebraska, 200 miles away. I was intrigued by one display at the Interpretive Center, lying flat in a glass case. It was a facsimile reproduction of a journal entry made in May 1850 by an Oregon Trail pioneer from Indiana, Margaret Frink, describing the scene from the rise above the river that I had just left. Today, the Hollenberg Ranch sits on a lonely, deserted spot on the hilly plains, with only the green vastness of the prairie grasses and the mosaic of yellow and purple flowers climbing the low rises, filling in the view. But Frink's 1850 journal entry described a starkly different place, a scene that could only be imagined 157 years later, looking out over the empty hills.
That was The Oregon Trail by Rinker Buck. Fatty O'Leary's Dinner Party is a new short novel by Alexander McCall Smith, beloved author of the number one ladies' detective agency. This story about a hapless American tourist, larger-than-life comical trip to Ireland, was shortlisted for the 2015 Bollinger Everyman Woodhouse Prize for Comic Fiction. Cornelius P. Fatty O'Leary and his wife Betty plan a vacation in Ireland for his 40th birthday, where they'll tour his ancestral homeland and relax in the beautiful countryside. Almost immediately, things go terribly wrong. The seats in economy on the plane are way too small. The country hotel's dinner spread and bathroom fixtures leave much to be desired. And the down-to-earth O'Learys find their fellow guests are more than a little snobbish. Stephen Crossley narrates.
Arkansas, with its abundant supplies of timber, was an ideal place for the furniture factory that Corney set up. He had gone to America to get away from everything that he regarded as being wrong with Ireland. Persistent rain, congenitally arrogant Anglo-Irish gentry, and a legion of squabbling relatives. Freed of Ireland, he became enthusiastically more Irish than ever before and set to the establishing of a modest dynasty of O'Learys, centred upon the rambling, double-storey house, Tipperary View, that he built in the centre of Fayetteville. It was not at all clear why he should have called the house this. It never had much of a view, and certainly not one of Tipperary, from which it was separated by 3,000 miles of ocean and a considerable slice of the American continent. But, as Fatty once remarked to Betty, we see what we want to see in this life. And it was undoubtedly true that if his grandfather had dreamed of seeing anything, it would have been those soft and distant Irish hills. As Fatty's birthday approached, a visit to Ireland had not been the first possibility Betty explored. She had looked into the feasibility of a week or two in Honolulu, but had decided that Fatty would probably dislike this. Neither of them particularly took to crowds and busy hotels, and she was sure that they would find both of these in Hawaii. Besides, she knew that a trip to Ireland would enable Fatty to seek out the ancestral farm from which the original Cornelius O'Leary had set forth on the fateful day in July 1910. It was possible that there were still O'Learys there and to locate some distant relatives. Betty was more cautious. She wondered what sort of unenterprising people would choose to remain in Ireland when they could easily have left the country, even if only to take the ferry to Liverpool. Well, they would soon find out, and if the Irish relatives proved to be at all embarrassing, they could be left right there. If, on the other hand, they were promising, they might be persuaded to emigrate, as Betty assumed that all sensible Irish people had either already emigrated to America or were at least actively contemplating doing so. Indeed, it was quite surprising that anybody remained there at all, other than those few needed to act as curators. Fatty was enthusiastic when he heard that Betty had booked the flights. They were to fly to Dallas, and from there they would continue their journey to Shannon. There they could hire a car and drive the short distance to Tipperary.
"How do you picture Ireland, Fatty?"
Betty asked dreamily.
"Do you have a clear image of it?"
"I certainly do," replied Fatty. "A lush green landscape dotted with tiny whitewashed cottages, and a patchwork of fields."
"And rain?" prompted Betty.
"Oh, yes," said Fatty. "Lots of rain."
"Marvelous," said Betty, "except perhaps for the rain."
"Gentle rain," went on Fatty. "Barely noticeable Irish rain, quite different from the rain we get out here. A little bit like whiskey, I think. Very weak, but still with the taste of the barley on it."
Betty laughed. Fatty shook his head fondly.
"Oh, Betty," he said, "you're a genius to have thought of all this."
They had only 3 weeks to wait. Then, on the morning of their departure, they closed up the house and were driven to the airport by Porky Flanagan. There they caught their plane to Dallas and were eventually herded through to the waiting room for the departure of their flight to Shannon. When he saw the name Shannon on the departure board, Fatty grabbed Betty's arm in excitement.
"I feel we're really on our way now," he said. "Shannon! That's Ireland, Betty! That's Ireland!"
Betty planted a kiss on his cheek.
"You've worked hard for this," she said. 40 years of hard work."
"Well, hardly," said Fatty. "I didn't start working the day I was born. Nobody does. 20 years, perhaps. 17 if you don't count college."
"Well, that's still a lot of work," said Betty.
We've just heard Fatty O'Leary's Dinner Party by Alexander McCall Smith. The answer is a great resource for deciding what to read next. Thank you, Alex. The question is, what is the bookreportradio.com website? Check it out next time you're searching for a great read. Readers, thanks so much for joining me today. To stay current on the book world, join me in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.